Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. On the occasion of the exhibition Tintoretto, Artist of Renaissance Venice, Eric Denker, Senior Lecturer at the National Gallery of Art, presents a four-part lecture series examining Jacopo Tintoretto's work in the context of 16th century Venetian art, history, and culture. In this final lecture, In Situ, Tintoretto in Venice, held on May 14, 2019, Denker discusses the many masterpieces by the artist scattered throughout Venice. Tintoretto was both a superlative painter and an ambitious entrepreneur. As a native Venetian, he worked for the Republic of Venice, for the church, and for charitable confraternities throughout his long career, often for below market prices. Without a carefully planned route through Venice, it is difficult to understand the trajectory of Tintoretto's career from his early experimental years to his mature work. This lecture offers a chronological itinerary that begins with the early work in the Accademia galleries, proceeding to the Church of the Madonna dell'Orto, the Church of San Cassiano, the Scuola Grande di San Rocco, and ends in the Ducal Palace.
Good morning and welcome to the West Building of the National Gallery of Art. I'm Eric Denker with the staff of the Education Division, and this is the fourth and final lecture in the series on Tintoretto in context. In prior weeks, we discussed the 16th century painting context for Tintoretto, looking at late Bellini, Giorgione, Titian, and some of Titian's rivals. In the second lecture, we discussed some of the early work of Tintoretto, how he became the Tintoretto that we so much admire today. And then last week in the third lecture, we spent an hour discussing the Scuola San Rocco and the 65 paintings that he did for this illustrious institution. And we will return to discuss that a little bit today. One of the aspects of Venetian art that we have to admit is that Venice is not always the best place to study particular Venetian artists. On the one hand, we can look at the work of Giovanni Bellini of the 15th century and see that the Frari altarpiece is still in place, that the San Zaccaria altar place is still in place, and that the San Giobbe altarpiece is available to us in the Accademia. And there are still places where Bellini's work can be seen, both in churches as well as in the Accademia. But when we move into the 16th century, this isn't always the case. And so there are only two Giorgione paintings in Venice. It was very difficult to know Giorgione without traveling a great deal to many different sites. Titian is represented by the two great paintings in the Frari, and certainly a couple of paintings in the Accademia, including the late Pietà. But in fact, in many ways, it's easier to see Titian's work and to understand the trajectory of his work if we go to the National Gallery in London, where there are 16 paintings that are by Titian. And I'll demonstrate that in just a moment. This is a map that was done by the civic museums in Venice for the celebrations for the 500th anniversary of the birth of Tintoretto. These are all the Tintoretto sites. And so there is a great deal to be seen, and there is a recent guide, an itinerary that has been put out. Save Venice supported it. It was put out by the Scuola San Rocco. It was edited by Frederick Ilchman and Robert Eccles. But that guide, in fact, goes by district, by sestiere. And while that can be valuable in one way, going to the places that are close to one another, in another way, it doesn't make very much sense at all for those of us who don't already understand the trajectory of Tintoretto's work. And so what I've done today is to select six particular sites and to give you some sense of a chronological approach. Now, we won't go to all of these sites, but we will certainly start with the Accademia, and we will then go to the Church of the Madonna dell'Orto in his neighborhood, very important church for him. We understand that he went and prayed there quite often in the latter part of his life. That we'll see one of the early parish churches, San Cassiano. We'll go back to San Rocco, although more briefly than last week. And then we'll go to the Doge's Palace and eventually conclude with the paintings that are on the high altar of San Giorgio Maggiore. And I will reintroduce the center part of this map several times along the way. When I mention that you can see Titian better in the National Gallery in London, here is the example that if you go to the National Gallery in London, you can see these two early portraits from around 1510. The man with the blue sleeve here on the left, now identified as one of the members of the Barbarigo family, or La Schiavona over here on the right, displaying this relief that shows her from the side as well as facing out toward us. And we see the realism of his early work, the detailed quality of his early painting. And at the same time, in the National Gallery in London, we can see some of the very compelling early religious works. The Nolle Me Tangere, the Touch Me Not, that we discussed in another lecture, but here in this context to show these subtle rhythmic early works, or the image that you see over here on the right, which is of a Holy Family. And these are works that show him as he's beginning to develop out of Giorgione's sphere. They had worked together at this time. From 1520 to 22, the Bacchus and Ariadne. And this is one of the paintings that was done at the time that he's working for Alfonso d'Este in Ferrara in his Camerino d'Alabastro. And so you get this sense of this larger mythic scene of these figures in full motion. And for the first time here, in the rich chromatic scale that he's employing in this early part of his career. You would also have the opportunity to see paintings such as the Vendramin family, venerating a relic of the true cross, a relic that is still today in the Scuola San Giovanni Evangelista above the altar in that confraternity. And so we have this group portrait and members of the family. This will remind you perhaps of the Madonna of the Pesaro family and the figures that look out and meet our gaze, that interact with us, as well as the older figures. And these are paintings, when we talk about them, yet though they are in London, that Tintoretto must have known in one form or another. And the same is true of these late mythological scenes. Here, the death of Actaeon from the 1560s. And these are being done at a time when Tintoretto is in the full throes of his maturity as well. And so we're going to start down here by the Accademia Bridge in the Accademia, which had been the Scuola of the Carità. And it's because in the Accademia, we have the greatest concentration of early work. And this is important to us. We can wander around Venice in and out of these various churches, but we haven't been equipped with any type of structure to understand what's early and what's late. We don't have that in our pocket. And so the way in which I'm going to approach it is to suggest that this is a way you can actually understand the progress of Tintoretto's career. And you start with the earliest works, and they are in abundance in the Accademia itself. And there are 16 paintings in the Accademia by Tintoretto. And so you would start with this very early work of Solomon and the Queen of Sheba. It dates to about 1545. And at the time that he does this, he's perhaps 25, 27 years old. And you can see the figures themselves are not very columnar. They're not very well developed. They're set back in space. And while there is an interest in the figures, light hasn't become as dominant as it will already by the time he reaches 30, within just a few years. But we see him flexing his muscles. We see him trying to work out various different ideas. And we can see that here in this presentation of Christ in the temple. And we see it by way of these large-scale figures that are off to the right and off to the left. And the image of that presentation there in the central ground. And then the spatial ambiguity that we experience between these different figures. We also begin to understand the reading of Tintoretto in a cinematic fashion, because here's that presentation. Other figures are waiting their turn, while yet others have already been up at the altar. And we see the very earliest of the large altar pieces, and this is an Assumption of the Virgin that's done around 1550. It's done for a church that was torn down in 1810, the Church of Sant'Agostino in Venetian. This is always contracted to be San Stin, S-T-I-N. And we get this full sense of this upward rotary motion as these figures here are surrounding the Virgin. And as you see the Virgin being assumed into the heavens, we understand that this is in fact a stone's throw from where Titian has done his Frari Assumption of the Virgin. And so even early on, now he's in his early 30s, he's competing in his mind with Titian, as Titian had competed in his mind with Bellini at the outset of his career. Large, robust, Michelangelesque figures. The small cherubs and seraphim don't seem in some ways capable of lifting this figure up into the heavens, who rises of her own volition and goes up bodily, in bodily form, into the heavens. Well, it's instructive to look at this just before you look at this. Now, the image that you see here, we've examined in different lectures. It is St. Mark and the miracle of the slave. It's the first of a series of three paintings he would do for the Scuola Grande di San Marco. And this one is the one that actually symbolizes his arrival on the stage in Venice. It is interesting to note that around the time that he did this, he must have married Faustina Episcopi. And Faustina Episcopi's father was one of the officers on the board of the Scuola San Marco. We have to remark on this engagement with different figures around Venice at this time. And we know that Tintoretto had other friends on the board and in the membership of that Scuola. So this is an important commission for him, and he's doing it for relative bargain for the Scuola San Marco. As you look at the painting, it's brilliantly organized and choreographed. The story goes back to the Golden Legend and the working of the relics of St. Mark. And in this case, it has to do with the slave or servant, depending on the story, down here, who works for the master who's up over here. And they live in Provence. And the slave decides to go to Venice and to pay homage, to dedicate himself to St. Mark by going and visiting the relics that are in the Basilica of San Marco. When he returns, the master is furious that he's neglected his work and decides to have him tortured and put to death. And that torture will be accomplished by these three figures. You can see this one, who is about to put out his eyes, this second one to break his legs, and this third one who will have attempted to break his jaw. But in fact, as each torturer approaches the slave, St. Mark intervenes. And here is St. Mark as he swoops down into the scene to save the slave. He's shown in silhouette with a burst of light, divine light behind him. But what's crucial is the hand that comes down and points to the slave, because it's that hand which stays all of these weapons and breaks them, and is, in fact, at the very vanishing point of the space as it's conceived. Nobody else seems very much aware of the presence of St. Mark. St. Mark's presence is perhaps only revealed to the slave as he saved from one torture after another. And again, we need to think of this in a certain way cinematically, so that the three figures would each have enacted their torment and would each have been stopped. And finally, this figure in this marvelous serpentine pose looks up. He shows his weapons to the master, saying, "St. Mark is too powerful. And God, through St. Mark, is too powerful." And this will cause the master to relent and then to make his own pilgrimage to see the bones of St. Mark in Venice. Notice the variety of different poses and the difficult foreshortening of the slave, which is matched by the foreshortening of St. Mark, and then the difficult figure who is bending over, and then again the circular movement of the figure with the turban. And then notice the great attention to detail and surface. When we talk about the fact that Tintoretto paints very quickly, it is inevitable that this was painted in a quite deliberate way, and that there must have been multiple drawings for each of these figures, studies from the human figure that he has reconciled before he's begun to do this work. Notice the chainmail on this figure, the Roman armor on this figure, and these are partly based on Michelangelo-esque models that are in the studio from the Medici chapels. Notice the figure here as she leans back and has one leg up, her knee, on part of the architecture. And she leans back so that she can see over to what's going on over here. And then the variety of other figures on either side, some of them all the way up here on the architecture. It is a masterpiece of coordination, of design. The space well rendered, the figures rendered expressively within that space. Now, the painting itself is very large. It was recently extracted from the normal place that it's shown to be put in a special exhibition on the young Tintoretto. And therefore, it was moved out of the Grand Gallery, which it normally shares with the Veronese of the feast at Cana. And once it was moved away from that immense painting, you got a much better sense of the scale and of how large these figures are. And the painting is larger than you see here on the screen. And a reminder that we now believe that the slave is a self-portrait of Tintoretto. That curly hair, that curly beard, and look at the nice details down here on the ground as well. The opportunity also presents itself in the Academia to see the two later paintings that should have been on either side of it. Two very large paintings here, The Theft of St. Mark's Body, executed between 1562 and 66. An image that suggests the story of a sudden hurricane that distracts the pagans from burning the body of St. Mark, and then allows the Christians to steal that body. It's placed in this deep perspective that is meant to be reminiscent of the Piazza San Marco and the arcades in the Piazza San Marco. And we're led back into that space with the rush of these orthogonals. We notice the balance where the figures are mainly off to one side, and remember it will be balanced by a painting on the other side of the miracle of the slave. An interesting note here to include this camel or dromedary back here, but more importantly, you will see that there are figures here on either side, and this is the Guardian Grandi of San Marco at the time, from Padova, the doctor, Tommaso Rangone, who's a member of a number of different scuole, and often appears in paintings as well as in statuary around Venice, in the Ateneo Veneto, on the facade of the Church of San Zulian. There are statues and busts of him by Alessandro Vittoria. And here, he actually supports the head of the saint as the body is stolen. You may also recognize over here that Tintoretto has inserted himself into the scene. On the other side would have been this painting, the image of Saint Mark rescuing a Saracen who is just converted from a shipwreck. And it shows, in many ways, the more visionary and fantastical style of Tintoretto at that point, as the figure is lifted out and saved to be taken to another boat. While down here, this man helps to steady the boat, and you will recognize Rangone, again, is in this image. It was, for Rangone, a way of exploring the idea of his importance in Venice at this moment. Likewise, if you're in the Accademia, you get to see portraits from different periods of Tintoretto's life. So here on the left, Jacopo Soranzo, a procurator in the robes of office. And this is a work from 1550, and it reminds us that Vasari and others tell us how prolific Tintoretto was as a portraitist. And these are particularly important early on. And then you could compare it. You can be in the same room and compare it to the portrait of Alvise Mocenigo. And you may well recognize him from the painting that we have upstairs of the Doge Alvise Mocenigo. It's in the permanent collection. It is in the middle of the room devoted to portraiture. It shows him from a slightly different angle, but it suggests the importance of portraiture in establishing the patrician and aristocratic ideas in Venice at this moment. We only brought one of these three paintings here. These are three of five Tintoretto paintings from a cycle on the Old Testament that was done for the Scuola della Trinità, and these were also done in the early 1550s. This is the kind of commission he began to receive on a regular basis after his success for the Scuola Grande di San Marco. And so this is a building that no longer exists. It is adjacent to the seminary that is next to the Salute. And when they broke ground for the Salute, the Scuola was destroyed. So the paintings, a number of the paintings have been moved into not only the Accademia, but into other museums. Here, you see the creation of animals, birds, and fishes that you can see upstairs. And as I think befits a proper Venetian, and remember Tintoretto is the quintessential Venetian, he's more interested really in the fish than he is in anything else. Yet there are some land animals down here, and certainly the birds, and they are mostly the kinds of birds that would have been seen in the lagoon and in the Veneto. So we recognize that he is really very much Venetian. Then the two scenes down below. And the two scenes that you see down below are of the temptation and the fall, and then Cain and Abel over here on the right. And one of the aspects of this cycle is that not only are the figures larger and therefore more expressive within the context of the landscape, but they prefigure images that he would do later on. And so you may well recognize that this is not so very far from the Scuola San Rocco fall from grace that we looked at last week. The way in which the figures are shown, this severe foreshortening, the musculature, all point us in the direction of Tintoretto's mature work and his understanding of a Michelangelesque vocabulary of muscular figures seen in difficult poses from a variety of different angles. It is also in the academia that you would get to see some of the earliest of the civic commissions. And while he'd worked with Bonifacio di Pitate earlier on commissions that must have been government commissions, in this case, these are two of his early masterpieces from the Palazzo Camerleghi, from the treasurer's office building, which is a building that even today is adjacent to the Rialto Bridge. These are two paintings that are meant to be seen as a pair. We only brought this one over to the National Gallery for the show, but these represent all four of the treasurers who were outgoing treasurers in 1552. And so it is still early on in the decoration of the palazzo when, instead of portraits, saints stand in for the particular families. And hopefully you've already had the opportunity to see this painting and to recognize St. Louis of Toulouse, in Italian, San Luigi de Francese, but in Venetian, Sant'Alvise. And that Sant'Alvise is here and stands in for Alvise Foscarini, whose family crest, whose stemma, is down here. And that St. George, with his horse, the princess he saves, and the dragon, represent another figure, in this case, Giorgio Venier, and that the Venier family, a very important family, leaders in the Battle of Lepanto, for example, and that they are represented by St. George, and that marvelous armor, and that pose, not simply static, but in movement that derives from his understanding of Titian's figures, very close by in the Frari, in the Church of the Franciscans. And then the figure here of the princess, elaborately clad. Clearly based on a male model, this is a reminder that he always works from male nudes or from male statuary, except in a very rare instance. And so it's a very muscular princess, as they tend to be muscular images of Venus and muscular images of the Muses. And I've pointed out in the past that not only are they pressed up against the picture plane, but they almost break into our space. And as you look, you can also see that she looks over and she regards herself in her reflection here in the armor. Well, this is the companion piece, and the companion piece is of St. Jerome and St. Andrew. Again, these are for the outgoing treasurers, and so St. Jerome represents Girolamo Bernardi, and there's his family crest down below, that's St. Jerome. And St. Andrew, with this cross, represents Andrea Dandolo, another famous name in the history of Venetian art. And in this case, you can see that the two saints to the far left and right are bookends to the crouching figures that are there in the center. And so you have to understand them being balanced together and not simply as isolated instances. They too, look at how Andrew's cross breaks out into our space along with those two family crests. And since we've looked at those two, it's necessary to go back and look at this painting, and we've been very fortunate in being able to bring this painting, which is of the Madonna of the Treasurers. And here, Tintoretto has developed this theme further by now including portraits of the treasurers and identifying them still with their family crests. So we know that this figure kneeling here is a member of the Dolfin family, that the figure in the center here is from the Monpiero family, and that the figure on the left is from the Pisani family. And there around the altar, which has St. Theodore, St. Mark, St. Sebastian, the Madonna and Child, and they've brought their secretaries with them. And it's the secretaries who carry the money and the coins. And over here it says that there is universal harmony, that this is a symbol of the harmony in Venice, of the way in which different classes get along and the way in which they work for the common good. And you can see that in those center figures. And finally, in the academia, you would see one of the greatest of the early religious works. And it is this deposition. And these figures are quite as large as you see them on the screen. And these were done for the Church of Santa Maria dell'Umiltà, Venetian for Umilità, Saint Mary of Humility, a church that was, in fact, destroyed in the 1820s to provide the space for the garden behind the seminary, behind the Church of Santa Maria della Salute. It was over the high altar, and it represented for Tintoretto the opportunity to have a great religious work of compelling passion. And we always remember how devout he was, strongly religious he was, and not only how religious he was, but how he was very much in tune with counter-reformation ideas, with the reform of the church, and the stress on figures that weren't classical figures but derived from everyday life, who occasionally had dirty feet. And for figures that would reinforce the importance of the intercession of saints and reinforce Mary's role as an intercessor. And finally, that would reinforce the presence of Christ's body and blood during the celebration of the Mass, not symbolically, but by way of transubstantiation, the actual existence of them on the altar. And so when you look at this painting upstairs, and you have an opportunity that you don't always have in Venice, because this painting is not always on display. It's a large painting, it takes up a good deal of space. But to see it here, you also realize that from where you're sitting, you would be looking past the altar where Mass was celebrated. And so you would be reminded of Christ's sacrifice while the Mass was going on. And so we have been down here. And chronologically, what I want to do is to take us all the way up here to the Church of the Madonna dell'Orto. And so he had parish churches, San Marcuola, which was close by, and perhaps his favorite church. But we also have to acknowledge that he's been working for the Scuola San Marco. And it's not here because there's nothing left in that scuola. It is now the entranceway into the Civic Hospital. But it was the lower and upper rooms and the albergo for the Scuola Grande di San Marco. And so you can see it's not all that far away, and he has good connections to it. And so here is the image of that facade, one of the great early Renaissance facades in Venice. And this is the main doorway in. Again, it's now the main doorway into the Civic Hospital from the land side. And that there is an enormous room, the full size that you see here behind it, and an upper room here. And it is directly behind this wall, this large wall between these two great mullion windows. Right here on the other side of this wall is where the miracle of St. Mark and the slave would have been placed. So there was light coming in from either of these two directions, but this facade faces south. So it's not a very strong light. And there are windows along the canal side. This is the Rio dei Mendicanti. And there are windows on this side that would have helped to illuminate that painting and the paintings that are going to be on either side that I just showed you. This space over here is the albergo. It's the boardroom where the Guardian Grande, the vicar, the Bonta, and the Zonta all met as members of this powerful scuola. Just out of our view on the right is the facade of the church. You just see the edge of it, of San Giovanni e Paolo, called in Venetian San Zanipolo, and often a major church, this is the major Dominican church, will share this ceremonial space with the Scuola San Marco. And just out of our view over here would be the statue of Colleone, the great condottieri, the great general that had been so important in the acquisition of land on the mainland for the Venetians. This is what that upper room looks like. And as with many of the important scuole, they had a hand-carved gilded ceiling, which remains intact and which helps to reflect light for the rest of the room. This is an exhibit that they had recently, which was on medicine in the time of Tintoretto. This is open to the public. There's a small charge, but it's open to the public. But what I wanted to point out to you is this is the same room seen from two sides. This is the altar, and there are still large paintings around the room, but these are the windows I just pointed out, and this is where the image of St. Mark and the slave, and then the theft of the body of St. Mark, and then the image of St. Mark saving the Saracen would have been. This is their original location. And if you go, make sure you go into the boardroom. These are all reproductions, but they are reproductions of the actual paintings now scattered between the Accademia and the Brera in Milan, but they give you a sense of what the room must originally have looked like when it was the boardroom. Venetians have been using this more and more lately, reproductions put in the original place to give you a sense of the light and a sense of the context. And whether it's out on San Giorgio Maggiore with the great Veronese, that is an image that is now in Paris, or whether it is in other locations, they are valuable even though they are reproductions. And so we've moved from here and we've come over and we're in Cannareggio, and here is that church that is of the Madonna dell'Orto, the Madonna of the orchards. And there is a small miracle working Madonna in their boardroom, in their side room, and it's still there today. And on the way, it's necessary, we're making a pilgrimage to see Tintoretto's work, to see where he lived. And so here is the house, and there's a plaque on the front, and this is the Rio della Senza, in that area, and all the walkways in this area of Venice, all the walkways are on the north side so that during the winter they get sun and a little bit of warmth. There is, in fact, a bust right here of Tintoretto. And if we were to go around to the other side, what we would find is that this is the back of the palace. It is the Palazzo Camello, because there's a sculpture of a camel on it, but this is the back of this palace, seen in an etching by Ernest Roth done centuries later, but called the Stones of Venice. And so here we come to the facade of the church. And before we enter into the church, I will mention that this is the kind of chevron pattern brickwork that was in front of many of the churches and in the squares throughout the 19th century, and then was replaced by the unforgiving stone, which doesn't absorb the water quite so readily. But this is what you should think of when you're in front of a church in Venice. And then this great Gothic church with this central aisle, which is so high, leading to the apse, and then the two side aisles. So we enter into the church. It has that familiar checkerboard pattern using Veronese pink marble alternating with the white marble, which is Istrian. And we approach the high altar. And as we approach the high altar, we get a sense of these enormous paintings on either side. And just out of our view over here, the organ covers that Tintoretto painted as well. And there, the high altar, and this enormous apse with paintings that he did more or less for the cost of the materials. And these are two paintings that were done at a particular moment in his career. And we talk about that moment in terms of a slight, perhaps, crisis of confidence. So that in the early part of the 1550s, Veronese has arrived in Venice, and Veronese will turn out to be a very strong rival for commissions. And he has a native ability. He is adept at the marvelous costume and textiles and light playing across these expensive materials and placing them in the context of great palaces, great arcades. And so it's on Tintoretto's mind that he needs to do something, again, to attract attention. And so he does these two great paintings. These are 44 feet high. They are the two tallest canvases ever painted during the Renaissance period. When you get this size in other places in Italy, it's fresco. It's not canvas. And so the scene on the right, probably done first, is the Last Judgment. The scene on the left is the making of the golden calf. And these are done in the early part of the 1560s. He's also responsible for some of the saints and prophets back here as well. But before he ever gets to that, in 1553-54, he begins the organ covers. And these paintings are still where the organ would have been, but the organ is no longer there. And as you look at this painting, it's important to remember that it started out as two canvases, which have now been sewn together. And they were the canvases for the doors of the organ when they were closed. And so it's perfectly appropriate that they are sewn together in this way. The image that you see here is of the presentation of the Virgin. And it is one of the great masterpieces of Tintoretto's career. So we see up a flight of steps, and we're pointed up as this large figure with her daughter points up. Perhaps this woman has already come down. And here is the presentation right here with a woman and a child right behind. And here's the presentation as she comes up here to the high priest. The stairs allow us movement up, ladder-like into the painting, but the strongest feeling is of these strong diagonals, which take us across. And what must have been very much in Tintoretto's mind at this moment is Titian. And the painting that he had done for the Scuola Grande di Carità, which is still in its original place, although the building has been converted into the Accademia. And doors were cut through. There was originally a door here, so compositionally it makes sense, but later on the door was cut through here. And so this is far more linear, and Tintoretto is reacting to Titian with the strong diagonals rather than being from left to right, more or less on the surface. And instead of this background of the Dolomites where Titian comes from, what we see is this obelisk and this dramatic sky. Of the two great paintings on the high altar, this one was the one that was done first. And it is of the Last Judgment. And there is no doubt in our minds that in his own mind, he's competing with Michelangelo and the Last Judgment that was done for the Sistine Chapel. And so we see the sacred figures up above. We see a variety of angels. They are interspersed with light. They rise up on clouds, those that will be saved, archangels as well. And then those that will be lost down below with this skeletal-like demon. And those down here, and it is exceptional that in the Last Judgment, that the judgment itself is a deluge. And that this is characteristic of Venice, where flooding is always going to be of the utmost importance and the most threatening of all phenomena. And so that's what you get down here, not the placid calm that you see of the boatmen and those that are damned in the image by Michelangelo, but instead the rush of water. And we're meant to understand that that water is flooding out and going to come into our space. Now, I've put the detail over here. You can see that skeletal figure. You can see the water as it rushes over the landscape in this waterfall, as it comes down and submerges a number of figures. Once again, however, we need to think in a certain aspect about these paintings cinematically, so that you are not permitted to be up on the high altar, You're part of the parish, you're out in the audience. And so the figures that would have been most accessible to you would have been these figures. These are the closest figures to you. So they are not only large, but they are fully developed. And we would be out over here. And we'd be looking at this oblique angle. Likewise, the making of the golden calf is over on the left side. And therefore, these figures are going to be the largest, most dominating figures because they're closest to us because our viewpoint is from over here. As you look at these scenes, you can see that he experienced something parallel to what Michelangelo experienced when he was painting the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. And that was that he started with smaller figures and crowded compositions that were not as readable from the floor. And that gradually he reduces the number of figures, he creates larger scale figures, he clarifies the narrative until we get to the creation of Adam, until we get to the creation of the sun and the moon, where there are quite large scale figures. That same kind of modification has taken place for Tintoretto, that instead of the scene being overcrowded the way the Last Judgment was, instead it's far more readable. Moses up here in contact with the Almighty above these clouds which separate this realm from the realm below, where Aaron stands over to one side collecting the jewels. Here, a woman takes an earring off of another woman, and the gold is still being collected, which will be melted down, and here the clay model of the golden calf will then be cast into the gold. It is a much clearer, much more quickly discernible subject for us. And Old Testament scenes are quite important in Venice. And I've mentioned before that there are a certain number of churches that are dedicated to Old Testament prophets who are called saints in Venice, so that there is a Saint Moses, there is a Saint Job, there is a Saint Jeremiah. And this was really quite unique in terms of Venetian beliefs. And so we had come all the way up here, probably taking a water bus all the way along the Grand Canal. And now from here, we want to go back down. And I want to stop briefly here before we go to the Church of San Rocco and then the Doge's Palace. We know that Tintoretto was born, although we don't know when, in the parish of San Cassiano. And so he returns to work in San Cassiano in the 1560s. And this is just after working in the Madonna dell'Orto. And he works there in 1565, and he does this painting of the resurrection of Christ for the high altar. And the two patron saints of the church, Saint Cassiano over here of Imola, and Saint Cecilia here, represented by her attribute because she is associated with music and is the patron saint of music. And this is the high altar, and it's the resurrection of Christ with the top of the tomb blown off, powerfully blown off, and with a number of angels surrounding and the armored figure in the background that's fallen asleep. And this is in a fairly small chapel, as you'll see in a moment. If you go to this church, it is unfortunate that there is a Baroque altar right in front of it. So in fact, you can't see this lower part of the painting. And I'll show you that in a moment. On the left side of this chapel is one of those laterale that we've been discussing. Lateral paintings, long horizontal paintings that were on the sides rather than above the altar itself. And here, he's returned in 1568. And doing a little bit of math, that would take you 3 years after the crucifixion that he had done at San Rocco, which we'll see in a few moments, and which we examined at some length last week. But that's a painting that you look at on the perpendicular. You look at from in front of the painting. Once again, this is an image that takes you up onto the high altar, a space that's a sacred space where you normally don't look at the painting. And so what he's done is to gather the figures together to reduce the number of subsidiary figures, and then to have a large figure over here, two figures, but a very large figure over here pointing in this direction as this figure ascends to put up the letters that represent King of the Jews here on the top of the cross. But this is not the correct angle. We should be looking at an oblique angle. This is what it looks like from the parish. And so you can see that these large figures help us, and we look in toward those crucifixes, and we get a very different point of view from outside over here. Here's that Baroque altar that all but obscures the whole lower half of the painting. And here is perhaps an even better angle. We are still outside of the raised platform. I'm on one side, but this takes us in, and you can see how strongly the diagonal works and how much better it works from outside of the space than from inside. It is opposite this painting, and this is from 1568. It's the Descent into Hell. It's quite dark. I think it has been restored to some extent, but it shows Christ. He points out, remember, this is a diagonal that leads us out to the audience, to the parish. And here he gestures down, and this is the demon down below as he brings figures up out of purgatory, and Adam and Eve. And this is one of the most vibrant female nudes that Tintoretto ever does, along with the Susanna and the elders that's in Vienna. And here is a case where he's actually done drawings from a female model, although it's not his normal way of working. And interestingly enough, a few members of the Brotherhood, no doubt, who have been put down here into purgatory. And here is the view that you would get, again, from outside of the platform. And you can see that the diagonal takes them down toward the figures beyond the clergy, toward the viewer. And so, of course, we go from the Church of San Cassiano, generally open mostly in the mornings. When you go to visit, there is no charge. It's a church that still does not charge to go and see the paintings. They have restored the organ, and if you go, there are concerts, and the acoustics are marvelous. So we're going to walk. We're in San Polo over here, and we're going to take a short walk past San Polo, Church of the Friar San Polo, where there is a painting. We'll come over here past the Church of the Frari, and here is the church and the Scuola di San Rocco. The church itself, with its much later facade, the Renaissance facade, the 16th century facade on the Scuola, and the little Scuoletta of San Rocco. And when we go to look at these paintings, we should first step into the church to see the two laterali, the two pieces that are on the sides of the high altar. The earlier one from 1549, the painting that you see here of San Rocco curing plague victims. Again, as part of the audience, we're over here and we're looking up past the diagonal, past this figure, to the saint, and there is an equal diagonal orthogonal that takes us in to the saint from up on the altar. On the opposite wall, now in the correct location, the image of San Rocco, who is in prison, healing those in prison, and the various different figures who have experienced torment around them, and this marvelous swooping angel, which is based on the same figure, the same kind of mannequin that was used for the swooping Saint Mark, which was seen from behind. Now the figure is seen and the drapery matches the figure is seen from the side. and of course then to go up the steps into the scuola. And to go upstairs to the albergo first, not to start downstairs, where it's dark and the paintings are later, but to go upstairs. And to first go to the albergo, the boardroom, and look at the competition panel here, 12 by 8, of San Rocco in Glory. The first of the paintings that Tintoretto will do for the scuola. And then getting the commission to do the entire albergo, he does the crucifixion. And this, I think, very deeply thought out composition of Christ here on the cross, but of the bad thief here just being nailed to the cross. And so we're meant to read this in a temporal way, so that this figure in shadow with his back to Christ just being put on the cross, the figure of the good thief being raised and being bathed in light, and then the crucified Christ himself. So we read it in sequence. As we read this central group of mourners of the family and followers of Christ, and as we read the figures of the Romans on horseback on either side and in the background. And you'll remember that I pointed out that the figure over here in blue is believed to be a self-portrait of Tintoretto present at this event. And so here, in a certain way, he tells us that it's autographed. He's present at these events, as well as the dedication plaque over here, which tells us that he did it in 1565 for the scuola. On the opposite wall, the three images that have to do with the Passion of Christ. And so we have these two images flanking the image of Christ presented to the people. Here, Christ before Pilate, Pilate washing his hands of their decision for Christ to be crucified. Here in a beautiful architectural setting, I think perhaps to indicate that he can do this as well as Veronese. And then on the other side, the carrying of the cross to Calvary. You can see that in the two thieves down here and Christ and the support, probably brothers from the Scuola San Rocco helping Christ with the cross and the idea of charity. And I want you to notice here, because I didn't bring it out so much last week, I want you to notice the costume and the physiognomy of this figure, because they are in fact repeated here. It's Pilate presenting Christ. So there is a connection between them as well. And then you go out into the Sala Superiore, the upper room, where we know that Tintoretto will work from 1575, doing the great ceiling paintings, Old Testament scenes of Moses, and then smaller ovals around them with Old Testament scenes, and that these scenes are meant to coincide with the scenes on the side walls. So that here, right at the outset, above us, Moses striking the rock is not far from an image of the baptism on one side, or the Pool of Bethesda over here. So that the Last Supper at the end of the wall over here is close to the gathering of manna and the miracle of the loaves and fishes. The responsibility of the scuola to feed the poor, as well as the sacrament of the Eucharist here toward the altar, as opposed to the sacrament of baptism at this end of the room, and the resurrection of Christ over here with the figure of Moses and the brazen serpent. And here is that great ceiling painting, which was the largest ceiling painting in Venice when it was put in place. And with Moses up here, and the brazen serpent, the bronze serpent, here on the cross, while victims down here of snakes bitten, reminding us symbolically of the plague that has just hit Venice in 1575. Here of Moses striking the rock, and the idea of sacred water. God up here slightly turned away from us, the water cascading down, and people gathering that water and also ministering to one another. And the gathering of manna, which is up in the front of the room. And how the walls of San Rocco are not meant to be read in a linear way. They are connected to the Old Testament scenes on the ceiling. And so this image of the adoration of the shepherds doesn't necessarily connect to the painting which is next to it, but gives us an image of the humility of the Holy Family and of the engagement with other humble figures here and up here. Or at the end of that wall, this image of the Last Supper, where Christ is far away from us at the end of the table on a diagonal that will lead down to the high altar, but where Christ is directly above and at the vanishing point above the poor who are being fed here down below. And opposite, the image of the loaves and the fishes. As we go downstairs, we need to acknowledge the importance of this painting, which is by Titian. Opposite the Visitation, and it is perhaps only a coincidence that Tintoretto dies on May 31st, which is the feast day of the Visitation. And so downstairs on the Sala Terrena, on the ground floor, images from the life of Mary, including the Annunciation here in humble surroundings, the angel once again swooping in, based on that same model, to this figure, this very robust figure of Mary, but with a column falling apart, with a chair with broken rungs, with the little bit of carpentry material with Joseph working outside. And perhaps the most moving of the paintings on this level, that image of the flight into Egypt, which was done toward the end of Tintoretto's career, and this sense of the natural phenomena which are supportive of the Holy Family. And as I pointed out last week, you'll notice that the flight into Egypt has them emerging and coming toward us. It's not left to right. It's not on a parallel plane. Instead, it would be understood as relevant to the viewer of that moment. Finally, we need to go over here from the Scuola San Rocco to go over to the Doge's Palace. Perhaps we've walked and taken the little gondola ferry at San Tomas here and walked. It's only about a half hour. Or perhaps we've gotten on the water bus at San Tomas and taken it down to Valoressa or to San Zaccaria over here, and we've come into the Doge's Palace. And we need to understand this in the context of the moment it takes place in Tintoretto's career. Because, in fact, when we get to the Doge's Palace, we have to acknowledge that there was a great fire in 1574 and a second fire in 1577, that Tintoretto had already been working in the Doge's Palace and his paintings had been lost. And Titian's paintings were largely lost. And the paintings by Bellini and other earlier painters had been lost. And so now Titian dies from the plague, 1576, and it is Veronese and Tintoretto who are on the scene who welcomed the opportunity to do great paintings. But they're not free to do whatever paintings they would like. There's a very careful consideration of reproducing paintings that had been there before. The subjects had been mapped out, and in paintings that were largely symbolic of the power of the Doge, of the Council of Ten, of the procurators, of the Senate. And so you come into a room, which is now the Ante Collegio, but was originally the Atrio Quadrata, And here you have four works, and they are entirely autograph works, and they are Tintoretto's finest works in the Doge's Palace. They're the ones that we want to spend the most time with. They are four scenes derived from classical mythology. Here, the wedding of Bacchus and Ariadne, and you have the opportunity to see it upstairs as well. They were moved in 1716 into the present location, but they should be one room further toward the golden staircase leading up. Again, large-scale figures inhabiting fairly small spaces with less interest in the environment and more interest in the figures, in their poses, and in the textures and tactile qualities of these figures. And so here, Minerva protecting peace and abundance from the god of war, from Mars. Minerva, in this case, symbolizes the wisdom of Venice in trying to protect from the vicissitudes of war. And look at the marvelous costumes, and look at the way in which that armor on Mars is done. Very sophisticated, very careful manner. And we progress to the Sala del Collegio, the chamber that was used to meet foreign deputies, where different parts of the ceiling will be Tintoretto, as well as image that you see beyond. And one of the paintings that we should mention here is Doge Niccolo da Ponte, who is invoking the protection of the Virgin, and they are accompanied by prophets and saints. But as you look at this image, now we've gotten into the last decade of Tintoretto's life. These are from the early part of the 1580s. And while he is doing the drawings for them, they are largely executed by Domenico and by members of the studio. And so they don't have the same vivacity. They don't have the same degree of interest in the creation of the surfaces, although the figures themselves are still based on drawings that Tintoretto has done and that he has trained Domenico, Marietta, and Marco to do. That is equally true of the Sala del Senato. The original paintings in this room were by Carpaccio, Giorgione, Titian, but they all perished in the fire of 1574. And so instead, Tintoretto gets to do that end wall, that painting there on the end wall, and he gets to do this large painting in the middle of this beautifully gilded ceiling. And there is the ceiling. The central ceiling of the Sala of the Senate, and it is of the allegorical triumph of Venice. So she sits here up above and below various different both religious and secular figures, and then Neptune and gods and goddesses around the scene below. Again, largely executed by the workshop. There may be a little more of Tintoretto's hand here in this work, which was painted over an extended period of time, the Dead Christ, adored by Doges Pietro Lando and Marco Antonio Trevisan. And so I've brought this detail from here because I wanted to show you the figures of the Doges on both sides, but also of patron saints and figures. It's a plague saint, Saint Sebastian, over here, and the introduction of the Doges on either side to this central figure. And this is in a room, the Senate room, where often foreign visitors would also be making their pleas to senators. And they see the Doges on the end wall in association with Christ's sacrifice and the importance of the Venetian state. Of course, the largest of the paintings, again, largely rendered by the hands of assistants, the Paradiso. And I call your attention to it here, above where officers would sit here in the Great Council room. And this, from here to here, is 70 feet. There are multiple canvases that have been sewn together. After the fire, The large work, earlier work here, had been replaced. There was a competition. Tintoretto wins that competition. And so the same subjects, and these are the same subjects that had been there previously, now renewed. And then the great paintings on the ceiling by both Veronese and Tintoretto. And there's a better image of the Paradiso. And you have the opportunity to see the Modello upstairs, which in fact Tintoretto rendered by his own hand, as opposed to this, which is largely workshop produce. And finally, a quick stop at the very end of his career over here on the island of San Giorgio Maggiore in the Church of San Giorgio to see the two last paintings, again, designed by Tintoretto himself. Perhaps drawings were done. But now the image that you see here, the Gathering of Manna. And again, this is a laterale. It's on the left side of the altar. So that's why these figures are so large, because we're over here. And it's opposite this Last Supper, the last of the Last Suppers that he does. And again, look at the scale of these figures, because we're sitting out over here. And I took this one photo so that you could see the angle and see the way it works in situ. Tintoretto, at around the age of 70, 68 to 70 here. He's run the great workshop in Venice over the last 35 years of his life. There are Tintorettos to be seen in numerous small and humble churches, as well as in confraternities, as well as the works that have been gathered together now in the Accademia Gallery. With his death on May 31st of 1594, in many ways, the chapter closes on 16th century painting, high Renaissance painting in Venice. Domenico runs the shop for a few more years, producing works, but none of them particularly distinguished. We know that Palma Giovine, the true heir to the tradition, works for another generation. But even so, his works largely mimic the works of Titian and Tintoretto earlier. A great draftsman, his paintings adorn many chapels and churches throughout Venice. But it's with Tintoretto that we actually conclude. And so over the course of the series, we've tried to see the context of Tintoretto first among 16th century painters, then his own development, his greatest masterpiece, the Scuola San Rocco, and finally, to have the opportunity to go around Venice with a sense of his development as he comes to the peak of his career, the works in the Scuola San Rocco, and then for the works in the Doge's Palace, both at the peak of his career and then in his declining years. I appreciate your attendance throughout the four lectures. I look forward to seeing you both in the exhibition and beyond. Thanks.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.